Okay. So welcome to Capital Link's discussion of money. As many of you know, shipping is responsible for transporting nearly 90% of the world's cargo. That's over $14 trillion every year. So I think it's in everyone's interest, including some of the more nationalistic leaders around the world, to keep ships moving and keep the economy humming along. Naturally, of course, ship owners need money to build, buy, and move those ships. And we're here to talk about how and where the money comes from. One of the buzzwords these days is diversification in finance. And one of the issues, of course, we're dealing with is geopolitical risk, which we've heard a lot about today already, as well as concerns about trade, the environment, competition, and growth, and AI as well. We've been hearing about that. So it's essential to have as many financial levers as possible. We're here to speak with some of the most prominent people in shipping these days, very active members of the ship finance community, starting with Sharon Guo on the far left. She's the Vice President for Europe and America for ICBC, the Chinese leasing giant. She's based in Hong Kong and has worked with European and American banks, European companies and American companies for many years. Next to her is Haris Kosmatos, the co-CFO of Tsakos Energy Navigation, which he joined about 20 years ago. And he was in banking and finance before that. And I have to say, Haris, your political science degree, it's probably coming in very handy these days. Finally, yes. And Eri Tsironi is the CFO of Navios Maritime Partners since 2018, 19. Before, she's been with Navios for over 10 years, and before that, a senior executive at DVB Bank. And Harry Sandonio is the founder and managing director of Neptune Maritime Leasing. Prior to that, had a long career in European banks, including as the head of shipping for ABN AMRO, and has built Neptune into a force to be reckoned with. We're also, I think, awaiting Christos Tsakonos from DNB Bank, and I guess he's MIA, maybe working on a big deal. But let's start with an issue that has been very prominent in finance in recent years, and that's deleveraging. And we've heard and seen a number of the big companies, big maritime firms, deleveraging, and the banks not too happy about that because that cuts into their profits. And oh, there he is. Okay, so we'll mention Christos. Yes, this is not Greek time. We're in Norway, so. So Christos Tsakonas, the head of shipping for DNB, of course, one of the most senior veterans of both the European and Asian ship finance markets. Thank you for joining us, Christo. So we were just about to launch into the discussion of deleveraging. And that's been a prominent issue. I think I've seen and heard, spoken to many bankers concerned about that. I would say in our industry these days, and I know I've heard you say, Christo, that if you want to lead a quiet life, you should not be in shipping. So how is that giving you gray hairs, the deleveraging of traditional owners, and how is DNB dealing with that trend?
First of all, banks should be very excited and happy that people are paying the money back. It's the other way around that you should really be worried. So, we are coming from a very, strong cycle in shipping. And what is very different compared to other ends of up cycles is that companies now have been very restrained. If you look at capital structures, they're very conservative. If you look at cash piles, they're very strong for most of the companies. And I think you will all agree with me that if you look at the uncertainty around the world, it makes you as a lender and also as a shipping professional feel very well that companies are so strongly capitalized to be able to tackle whatever comes ahead. Of course, we are in the business of lending money. You know, we make our money from lending. So when owners are borrowing less, that is a challenge for traditional banks, no question about that. And we have seen that. We've seen repayments being much higher than what we have seen in the past. But we have reacted to this by increasing the velocity of the capital and lending money faster. We are holding bigger tickets when we are comfortable with transactions and clients. So we don't distribute as aggressively as we have done in the past. But at the same time, these healthy capital structures have been a very big advantage for us. Our cash management business is doing extremely well. Our private banking business is doing extremely well. We've been very, very active on the M&A side because people are using their liquidity to buy companies. We advised on the Euronav Frontline transaction. We advised on the Golden Ocean sale. We advised on the acquisition of Gram by MSC, on the Avance sale. So it's, you know, for us, it's been actually very, very good. And in all this M&A activity, of course, you typically have financing attached. So a lot of the volume has come from there. The equity markets have not been that busy. We've done 5 deals over the last 12 months, but on the high yield side, we've been extremely busy, having done over 10 transactions the last 10, 12 months. And of course, again, on the high yield side, you do have bridge to bonds quite often. So there is financing there as well. So I would say for a bank with the breadth of the products that DNB has, it's been very good that shipping markets have been strong. People have strong balance sheets. They've been using them to buy companies, and it has helped us service clients in a broader way.
Thanks. Sharon, finance leasing exploded on the scene a few years ago. Chinese leasing especially is your specialty. We've also heard stories about companies exiting their leases a little early. Tell us about your experiences and how ICBC is dealing with these trends.
Thank you, John. And thank you for having me here. Over the past few years, ICBC Leasing has evolved from the alternative financial solution provider to one of the major ship finance channels for the ship owners and the end users. The journey we have taken has never been a bed of roses, but a path filling with all kinds of challenges. The pioneer leasing houses, of course, including ICBC Leasing, was established in 2007, 1 year after it was the financial crisis, and it had a significant impact to the shipping industry, of course, in a very negative way. And we see many of the shipping companies were struggling with their liquidity issues, and some may even face the difficulties in financing their new buildings. From today's view, of course, we can say that it was a super good timing for the Chinese leasing companies to jump into the market. But I think under that circumstances, by the time, I still believe that it was a pretty bold move and it required a lot of courage and even the venture spirit. And many of us know the story after that. The Chinese leasing houses navigate themselves through the difficulties and filling the gap of the shipping finance. Even during the pandemic, we haven't slowed down our pace. We kept push forward and try everything we can to provide continuously support to the client who need us. I talked so much about the history of Chinese leasing. What I really want to say is that we deeply understand the market and we truly believe that the execution efficiency, the resilience, the trust, flexibility, value in this market. So going forward, we promise we will keep all those core values strong. Because of today's geopolitical risk, and maybe the Section 301, we might see some of our clients, they may hesitate to exercise the early purchase option. But to be very honest, we haven't seen much for the time being. I believe the reason behind is that some of the clients, they just want to take a wait and see approach until things are more clear. But from my perspective, as a financier, as long as it's for the best interest of the client, no matter the clients want to just optimize their capital structure or they simply want to reduce the geopolitical risk exposure. As a financier, we have to do everything we can to support and cooperate to ensure a smooth repurchase, because we see the relationship with the client as a long-term relationship. It's never been a one-deal relationship. I think nowadays, the number one concern for many of us ahead is the uncertainty. Because of the uncertainty, really make things hard to predict. From our company's perspective, I think the best answer for that we can give is to make the preparation as much as possible. Here, the preparation for our company means that we always keep a good asset and liability duration management so that we can keep our cost of funding as low as possible, always close to the market, understand the need from the client, and be ready to provide the tailor-made solution for the ones who need us. I just want to add a little bit more about our cost of funding. I think for the client who are very familiar with ICBC leasing can evidence that. ICBC leasing is still very, very competitive in the financial terms, especially in the pricing. For those who are not familiar with that, maybe after this panel, we can exchange a business card and talk about it. I won't disappoint you.
Thanks. Harris and Eri, from the ship owner side, have you experienced deleveraging? Maybe Harris, start with you.
Well, it all depends on how leveraged you are. And we as a company, we like debt. We always source debt as our kind of first port of call. And it all depends on the project. And considering that most of the vessels that we have built and we are building, and I should say that in a pro forma fleet of 82 vessels, the majority of the vessels have been built for our own account against long-term employment. So we have always gone out to seek very attractive bank debt at very good terms, and we feel that we, you know, based on the levels of debt that the company has raised and the quality of the fleet and the cash flow visibility that we are creating by having these long-term contracts, allow us to raise perhaps a little more debt than others would have felt more comfortable with. I would say approximately, you know, new buildings, we are seeking 80%, and on vessels in the water, and we're between 60 to 70% of fair value or contract value in the case of new buildings. So we never, you know, been a company that has been around, you know, forever since, you know, the early 90s, and having gone through thick and thin and all the global crisis and everything in between, we've never felt that the company, based on the leverage that it had and currently has, will be under any threat. And this is kind of our modus operandi, that we will never over-leverage the company in order to be under threat in any situation, no matter how prolonged that crisis may be. And this is a tried and tested model that it seems that and touch wood, that it has worked and is working. So even in good markets like today, we will not go over and above our kind of principal, you know, payments to the bank. So we will not go out and deleverage just for the sake of deleveraging. It's kind of a juggle. You know, we have so many balls in the air. Obviously, you know, we need to make sure that we generate enough cash to meet our debt obligations, and we have never ever had any issues with that. We need to have cash to make healthy dividend payments. Again, something that we have been very very committed in doing since the company's New York listing in 2002, and also have capital for growth. And again, this is our kind of second port of call after debt, where always the plan is to use our own equity and then resort to other potential sources. And obviously have enough cash as a safety net that we would like to have on the balance sheet without really needing to access, just to make us feel comfortable that the company has this kind of fodder that could potentially tap, but ideally not to. So we always pay attention to our debt levels, and as long as we feel comfortable that the cash that we generate and the cash flow visibility, on this instance, we are with 21 or 20 and 19 by the end of the week, new buildings under construction, the majority of them on long-term employments, who have close to 3.7 billion of revenue backlog. So that makes us very comfortable, and based on the debt levels that we have, that we don't need to resort to an additional debt pay downs in order to create breathing space for the company. We feel very comfortable based on the current debt levels that we have.
Harry, same question to you. I mean, Navios has built a consolidated behemoth of various vessel classes. So there was a lot of leverage going in to the company. It seems like there's a lot less in recent years. Tell us about your experience.
Yes, thank you, John. Actually, our company is one of the few listed companies that has three asset classes, which is dry bulk, containers, and tankers. We have consolidated the different Navios entities into one umbrella, and currently our company has around 170 vessels, including 20 new buildings. Our model is very simple. We are time charter focus oriented. We also have a backlog of 3.5 billion. Whenever we order a new building vessel, also given the current prices, we make sure that the vessel has some sort of employment at least 5 years. We have vessels running for 12 years time charters as well. We have publicly said that our focus is to reduce leverage, and we have, since the initiation of the consolidated company a few years ago, we started at roughly 50% net loan to value. Currently, we are just above 30%, with the aim to go down to 25% over time. Having said that, of course, when we do a new project on our new buildings, we seek some finance, usually in the region of 65 to 70%. And for the existing fleet, we just let the loans run down as they were originally planned, so refinance basically the balloons at the same levels that they were before. What is important for us now, given the uncertainty going forward, is to have more flexible financial products. That's why I think we are seeking to do more revolvers with our financiers. So basically have the debt ready if there is a need to use it or to do a project or to buy a vessel. But if you don't need it or if there is not such an opportunity, then just to have it on standby. I think our model has proven to be a very stable one, because not all sectors usually move in the same direction. You can also have more time charter opportunities because, as I said, we are a time charter operator. The dry bulk sector has not been that exciting in terms of time charter opportunities. But we have managed initially starting on the container market. We have long-term time charters on containers. Then the tanker market proved to have the similar opportunities. We beefed up our time charter contracts on the tankers. So basically, at any given year, at the beginning of the year, all our existing time charter contracted revenue covers the full cost of the company, and whatever the spot vessels are making just adds to the bottom line.
Thanks. So, Harris A, in this environment, high interest rates and higher interest rates and sort of a trend toward deleveraging, how do you find the market to deal with, and where are you finding customers?
In Oslo, to start with. we set up the company about 5 years ago, 4 years ago to be precise, but the idea was planted on our head a little bit longer than that. And as you mentioned, we have a long, all of us at Neptune have a long history in banking. And you know, we thought, okay, what are we trying to solve for? And the things that we were trying to solve for were issues that were pretty high up in terms of priority in the minds of our clients. And we thought in three terms: security, affordability, and the environment. And security back then was not what security is today, because the security that we thought of was not related to geopolitics, but it was related to the fact that, you know, shipping and asset-based finance back then and for a period of time had become sort of a villain in the eyes of regulators and you know, what banks were able to achieve. So we wanted to make sure that we solve for security in terms of availability of funding to ship owners so they can continue growing the companies and service the world trade, which is basically what we all live off. And we did this, and we decided to set up a company that is going to solve for the availability of capital in a counter-cyclical manner, not a pro-cyclical manner that, in fact, regulation forces banks to follow. And that's what we did. And I'm very happy to report and to have seen that, in fact, a lot of people actually thought that what we did was a good idea. Of course, you know, what we saw was back then a massive exodus of a number of European banks that traditionally funded the shipping industry. Who came to the rescue were, of course, our Chinese colleagues with leasing companies. But there was no local solution, so we decided to also go for a local solution. We set up a company which is based in Europe and has European sort of interests and shareholders behind them, and went out to help our clients grow. That solved the issue of security. Of course, security later on also became geopolitical security that is very high up in the minds of people and their priorities. But I suppose that's something that everybody is familiar with, so I don't need to delve too long into it. The other issue that was quite interesting that we thought that clients are solving for is affordability. And affordability not in the eyes of the very large companies that we have represented here, that were always able, in fact, to capture the best in the industry could offer, because they have the size. You know, Airy and Harris here represent companies that are, you know, very large in size and been able to be in the forefront. But there's also a layer of companies that we thought was left unattended. And these were the sort of medium-sized or even smaller-sized companies. So we started focusing on the asset and not on the balance sheet. And by focusing on the asset, we were able to unlock leverage for the ones that really needed it. So, and how is that related to affordability? It's related by the fact that we decided to do that in scale. So, you know, we financed more or less 50 ships in the last 4 years of our existence, and we will be continuing to grow. We have been lucky to attract two very strong and well-reputed shareholders to help us grow the company. The first was the Latsko family office out of Geneva, and the second and largest shareholder that we have today is Costa Mare Inc., which is a container shipping company listed in New York. Their understanding of shipping, you know, helped us, you know, grow quite quickly. And last but not least, I wanted to also mention the environment. From the outset of you know, the our operations, we also focused on how are we going to help our clients and companies go through the energy transition, because we always believed that the energy transition is a one-way street. It's happening. It's going to happen. We're going to have triple the amount of electricity and energy produced out of nuclear and renewables in the next few years, and we need to find a way to convert those green electrons into green molecules. And shipping is going to be a very, very important sector in the process. But what we and of course this is why people talk about, you know, new buildings, dual fuel, etc., etc. But what we realized was that, in fact, by 2026, which is next year, 45% of the existing fleet will be marked D or E in CII terms. So if you were to erase that 45%, half the fleet, the global fleet, from the equation, you would have no sufficient capacity left to help the economy grow. So we thought it's very important, actually, to help our clients with retrofits, in fact, extend the lifespan of the fleets until such moment as the new buildings arrive, and importantly, biofuels or other forms of, you know, green energy is available to power the world fleet. So these were the basically the three elements that made us go for it, was security, affordability, and the environment. Thank you.
Thanks, Harris. Actually, that's a great segue to my next question to Christos. The Poseidon principles, to which DNB was one of the major signatories and proponents, have been criticized by some as being more talk than action. Can you share with us how DNB is implementing them in its loans and finance regimes, and how does or where does decarbonization lie these days in the list of priorities?
I mean, first of all, yeah, we were one of the three banks that set up the Poseidon Principles some time back. And I have to say at the time, this was probably one of the best things that banks did in shipping, because we managed to put a number on the carbon emissions of our book. We managed to show internally all the good work that owners have been doing to reduce these emissions. And by starting to measuring this, you know, we started setting targets and a pathway towards decarbonization. So, you know, at the time, they served a very, very good purpose. Now, the world has caught up with the Poseidon Principles. You know, we have the IMO now that has set, you know, also very ambitious targets, and the Poseidon Principles is following that. But we also see the industry's approach towards energy transition becoming much more mature. People realize that, yes, we need new engines. Yes, we need new fuels. Absolutely. This is likely to take more time than we originally thought. And there is a lot of risk associated with this as well. And owners, certainly the ones we speak to, but I think it's more general in the industry as well, are focusing more on how can we make the fleet on the water more environmentally friendly. And there is a lot you can do to improve the energy efficiency of the fleet on the water. And a lot of people are doing it, particularly in Norway, but also other parts of the world. So I think the main focus when it comes to ESG has to be, we have commissioned these vessels, they are on the water. How can we make it better? How can we make them more environmentally friendly? Is it even possible to trade them longer? I think that is key. When it comes to Poseidon Principles and new technologies, we absolutely want clients to experiment with new technologies. We want clients to be aware, you know, of new technologies, but they also need to be mindful of the risk associated with these technologies and the availability associated with it. So when it comes to our credit assessment, we put all this in the mix, and we want to back owners who are aware, who are prepared and ready to take measured risks when it comes to new technologies and new fuels and new engines.
Great. Sharon, the question to ICBC also is, does sustainability agenda have a high place in ICBC's list of priorities also? Where do you stand?
Yes, for ICBC, we are committed to to support the decarbonization and the green shipping. If you look at our fleet, you can see every year there will be an increase in the green ships. The LNG vessels, LPG vessels, and all the other alternative fuel power vessels. But we have to say that because we are not the expert of the vessels, and we think that the operator and the ship owners, they may have a better position than we do to choose what type of the vessel they need. As the financier, what we can do is that we ensure that when the vessel is included in our fleet, and we make sure that the vessel is compliant with all the environmental regulation, and we do an ongoing basis monitor for that. But it doesn't mean that we are no longer interested in the conventional vessels, because I think those conventional vessels will not just phase out overnight, as long as they can comply with the environmental regulations, we will still willing to support them as well.
Thank you. We're actually starting to run low on time, so I wanted to hit on the elephant in the room these days, which is the United States tariff policies and the trade restrictions up and down, in and out. This morning they said that the tariffs are here to stay. Tsakos Energy Navigation and Navios do a lot of U.S. trading as well, and how do you see that playing out and affecting your business? Harris, to you.
Well, Harris, obviously, okay. We need to wait and see on how this whole saga unfolds with you know, the new tariffs, China, and all these new policies that they seem to be creeping up from you know, from nowhere over the last few months. But all in all, we do not feel, you know, being a tanker operator, having modern vessels primarily built in Korea and Japan, that we will be impacted as a company and potentially as a sector, the tanker sector as well, particularly as we're seeing, you know, U.S. Oil exports, even though they have plateaued recently, but still at very high levels. And I think the overall policy of the U.S. administration would be to increase both LNG and you know, crude oil exports to various places in the world, which could potentially be additive to our business just by virtue of having, you know, longer ton mile, which is obviously very profitable for in terms of the supply and ultimately, you know, the bottom line. So we need to wait. But it seems that you know, our sector will not be detrimentally influenced by the current situation. Overall, obviously, you know, the freer the trade, the better. We don't like to see, you know, such obstacles because you never know how they could develop, and you know, no one knows you know, what the future entails with this administration, the Russian situation, what will happen with China. So potentially things could derail, but as things stand, I think we do not expect anything particularly negative that will impact at least our operations.
Mary?
Actually, we did a study on actual fleet calling the U.S. ports in 2024. Where the tariffs, of course, were not in place. And what we realize is that, as I said, we have 150 vessels in the water. Roughly one third of the vessels called the US ports. Of those, let's say 50 vessels, around 20 were actually Chinese built. And of those 20, some of them were loading, some of them were exempt due to size because the tankers below 55,000 deadweight are exempt and the dry bulk below 80,000 are exempt. So basically we were left with 11 vessels that have been or could have been affected, actually two bulkers and nine containers. What we saw then for the nine containers is immediately starting 2025, the charters of the vessel moved the vessels out of the U.S. trade because they were Chinese built, and now they are trading Asia. So I think all in all, although when the regulation started, it seemed that it will have an impact, I think that there will be some impact on the container sector. But there, you know, the liners have the flexibility to move the vessels around, so making sure that the Chinese vessels do not call U.S. ports. I think for us as an owner, around 25% of our financing comes from Chinese leasing. And this is the area where we see there is some uncertainty. We have a wait-and-see approach because, of course, we are the ultimate owners of the vessels. We have purchase obligations to buy back the vessels after a few years, so we believe that that should not classify the vessels as being Chinese ownership, but we have to wait and see what the developments will be.
Harris, are you seeing any impact on your business by the U.S. policies?
Well, positive, if any, but The U.S. policies have a different impact, I suppose, on trade, and what we see is this geopolitical rivalry is leading to what somebody called peak trade, like we call peak oil, in the sense that regional clusters of countries or countries themselves are trying to, in fact, do less trade, hoarding commodities, hoarding the materials that are required for the energy transition, etc., etc. So I think what we need to watch is whether this hoarding of commodities, critical metals, etc., is going to affect, and in what way is going to affect shipping. As we see, you know, the development happening more regionally, which means that that may also affect the type and size of ships that we need going forward. This probably will affect less the energy flows, but more of the other flows, container ships, bulkers, etc. So we're vigilant, but hope that everything will be resolved for the better.
Risla, do you see DNB going into financing the U.S. shipbuilding market?
I think this very, very grand plans from Mr. Trump to rebuild the shipbuilding industry in the U.S. Maybe we see something on the LNG side, but not likely. But I am with Harris here. I think all these policies, they introduce inefficiencies, and this is probably good for shipping and for ton miles. So net-net, probably it's a good thing, maybe with the exception of car carriers and containers, where again, in containers, people will be reshuffling fleets, so there could be a lot of inefficiency as well. So, bizarrely, this could also be a positive for shipping.
And since we're down to just a few minutes, a quick question for all of you. Do you see, and maybe you can rank it on a 0 to 100 scale, what is the risk of the U.S. dollar being no longer the reserve currency in the next 10 years? Let's start with we'll start with you, Harris.
Currently the U.S. dominated assets in our portfolio accounted for more than 90%. And I think that this situation is pretty much the same among all the other leasing houses in China. We haven't seen much changes for the time being, but we are always open to discuss the alternative that may better suit the need of the client. But my personal view is that I think the currency cannot be changed overnight, because why the US dollar dominates is because the US dollar, they just show up in every phase and every part of the business chain as a settlement currency. And the money the ship owner used to pay the financial institution come from their charter hire, the free rate, which are mostly in U.S. dollar. So I think going forward, from the perspective of the financier, rather than leading or driving this change, I think we just try to adapt to the market and accommodate to the client's need.
Risto?
I mean, all I would reflect on is what a great opportunity for the euro. I hope European countries have the leadership and the courage and the ability to take this opportunity. We'll see. But I think it's very difficult to break away from the dollar.
All right. Harris, what about you?
No, I concur. I mean, unless Europe takes over, the U.S., which I don't see this happening anytime soon. I don't expect the U.S. dollar to not to be the currency of business, of commerce. Depending on the size of your company, the operations, you will shy away from accepting any other currencies than the U.S. dollar, no matter how serious the other the counterparty may be. At least as far as TEN is concerned, it's the U.S. dollar all the way.
Okay. Ari, the drachma didn't come back during the crisis, so is the dollar still the way to go?
Yeah, at least for our industry, I think this is the way it is, unless, you see fundamental changes, which I think they will take a lot of time to happen. So,
Harris?
I think the bigger question is whether In fact, we're going to see the substitution of currencies altogether by digital currencies. And I think, you know, give it a few years and, you know, most likely we will have alternatives, also supported by technological advances. You know, people in the previous panels were talking about AI, tokenization, distributed ledger technology, Bitcoin. So I think there's an element of that going on. And I think the polemic will be between, you know, centralized digital currencies and privately owned and funded digital currencies. I think that's where the tension is going to be.
All right. Well, that's a good something to think about going forward. And with that, I'd like to thank our panel. And I think our time is up. So thanks again, and to be continued.